Okay. I bet some of you all have questions. David here is going to take this mic, and what we're going to do is we're going to collect about 5 questions, and then we're going to give everyone on the panel an opportunity to address those questions to the extent that they want to. Please do not take more than a minute with your question, because we would like to have several rounds of questions. I see that there's a lot of folks. I can't see you all in the balcony because of the lights. Do some of you have questions? Shout if you do. Okay, so at some point, one of the rounds of questions, we'll send David up to you, but we'll start on the floor.
I'd like to raise up the something which straddles these, which is a plowshares type of activity, which is, would by a question of destruction of property not be considered nonviolence, but which is practiced nonviolently by many of our good friends.
Can you repeat that one more time?
Plowshares is a type of property destruction which is very, very carefully focused on something which actually needs to be destroyed, like a missile. And people go with sledgehammers and pound on these missiles and cause a significant amount of damage to them. How does this fit with this dichotomy you're discussing?
In the back there with the wristband.
I've heard a couple of different positions espoused. Are we trying to overthrow the capitalist system, or are we trying to repair the existing system? Another way of asking that question to my mind is, are we the 99% or are we the 15%? Or the 10%, or the 7%.
Can you pass it back to Annie Danger?
A problem that I've heard on the panel with most of the panelists tonight, while I agreed with certain things and disagreed with others, is that there seems to be a conflation of issues about violence or nonviolence. And the left often seems to want simplistic answers of either one way or the other. I was with a group of people who had a non-property destruction proposal for their General Assembly that was voted down. And I think a problem is Reverend Lawson, if I have your last name correct, I don't believe that your analysis of King was right. King was not a pacifist, and there's no analysis of why nonviolence ostensibly worked with Gandhi in India, whereas he said it would not have worked in apartheid South Africa.
You're at 40 seconds. What's your question?
Thank you. I have 40 more seconds. Yeah, I'll wrap up.
You have 10 seconds.
So I certainly agree with the Iraq veteran against the war who said that we need to learn to reach out to a broad-based movement. And so I think the issue ought to be when and where violence is appropriate and when and where violence is not appropriate, and that they can coexist as parallel movements.
Thank you. In the midst of the crowd there. No, in front.
Hi. Okay. I feel a little disappointed right now. I feel like I came to a discussion about tactics, which inevitably leads to a discussion about strategy, and what it devolved into really quickly was people coming up with the worst possible outcome and then using that in this same old, like, capitalist binary way of saying, well, if this thing was wrong, then you're wrong. What do you think of that? I think that's really disappointing, and I think it points to a lack of, not a lack of imagination, but a failure of us to fully engage our imaginations as we're looking for greater solutions and looking for ways forward. And in that sense, I support a diversity of tactics because I support fluidity. So my question is two. One, what do you think brought this discussion to the table? And number two is, how do we move through this discussion and out of it? Because with diversity of tactics discussion, shut down discussion of strategy only when we lack the imagination to work through them and to be compassionate toward people on the other side.
My question to all of you on the panel, having listened to each other, I hope, this evening, is what do you think, having heard each other, is the common ground that we all hold together that will move this movement forward?
So that's it for that round of questions. I just want to clarify, I misspoke earlier. Instead of 2 minutes per panelist, each side of the table has a total of 4 minutes to respond to that round of questions. And then after each side has responded, we'll take another round of questions. And there was a request that this side start first. Are you guys okay with that? Okay, so you have 4 minutes. Yeah, 4 minutes altogether. You can each speak for a minute, or I think one of the things we had talked about is two of you speak in this round and then two others the next round, however you want to break it up.
Okay, my response is to the lack of imagination and the binary manner with which we're talking about this. And I'd like to just say that nationally, we've got a lack of imagination. Our reality is socially engineered, and you know, perception is everything. The reality is what people know, and it's socially engineered, it's an official history. The general public does not know what the majority of us who are passionate about this stuff know. So we need, I would advocate education over any radical tactics. And I don't want to get worst case and disaster minded with all this. I just think that education needs to be our number one priority. We need to be reaching out and telling people, like the United States has overthrown 50 foreign governments since 1945. All these things. It's we're so drowned in rhetoric from either side. And there's been 40 years of social engineering to, make people be repulsed by this rhetoric. And we need to be creative, create new ways to say the same thing that is not going to just turn people off viscerally. And that's.
Let me, I want to say that the issue of violence in the movement that I've been associated with has been a part of the debate of around how we should move in this country from the very beginning. There was no exclusion that there would never be a violence as an option. Gandhi, in fact, indicated that if you are, rather than you be a coward, you should respond physically. So violence has not been, isn't something that we don't want to consider. It's that violence itself is the major enemy of people today. So, violence is not something we should play around with. It's the major source of pain and suffering in the nation, in the world. It itself is an enemy. So to even talk about using violence today doesn't make sense with the proliferation of violence in our country. We ought not to be romantic about it, about violence. There's an African a proverb, a story, that the African ancestors, after men of the village went into war, before they could come back into the village, they had to spend 6 weeks out in the bush, divesting themselves of the spirit of violence, so that would not be brought back into the village. I want to suggest it's that spirit of violence that we're playing with. that is dangerous in the world today and causing much more suffering than ever before.
You guys have also 4 minutes.
I'll just keep my response really brief. The first thing I'll say in terms of the first question, I think the plowshares example is a great question. I think that's one of those things that I brought up earlier in terms of those gray areas that in my experience tends to get pushed out in movements that claim to be exclusively nonviolent. I think if in this Occupy movement, if a group of people decided that maybe the police cars or trucks that were bringing all those police into those situations, if there was a group of people that needed to go and find those vehicles and dismantle them, I don't think most people who are arguing for exclusively nonviolent movements would accept that as a nonviolent tactic. Maybe I'm making assumptions, but that's totally based on my limited experience. But in my experience, it wouldn't even come up. The idea would be squashed really quickly.
Sure. To the question about how do we work through this conversation? I think that this is one of those amazing moments, right, where we have this audience, and it's something I dream of where I'm like, oh my God, I get to say exactly what I think the world should look like. But then I freeze because I remember that I'm not the only person in the world. And I think that we have to freeze and remember that each of us are not the only person in the world. How do we move through this? I think that really, in particular with the Occupy movement, we say, check it out. We are going to have this nonviolent demonstration. It is going to be nonviolent. It is explicitly nonviolent. You are not allowed to come if you do not plan on using nonviolent strategic action. This is what it looks like. I think that it is totally fine. And I think that people can agree to that. I think that you can have another action and say, you know what? This is going to be an action where we encourage diversity of tactics. We encourage as much transparency as possible. And I think that that is also fine. I think that if we keep on butting up against, no, it can only be this, or no, it can only be that, then we're lost. We will actually never go forward. All of our actions will be symbolic in name only.
So I deeply believe, and I agree with Reverend Lawson, that violence is toxic. And I think that's a fair criticism. Violence does hurt, and it is damaging. I've spent most of my life somehow engaged around the issue of violence, and I've come to respect it, not to fear it. And there are times when violence makes sense. And I will utilize violence to protect myself or my family or my friends. I think those are the easy ones. And I will use defensive violence, violence that doesn't hurt people, to further my political goals, just like a lot of people in this room will. I think that property destruction is violent. I'm one of the rare ones who actually thinks it is violent. I think it's violent because it's scary. And I think intimidation is a form of violence. And I think we're deluding ourselves to say that the acts we do and the sort of mindset we're trying to create don't affect people, don't touch people on a way that really makes them feel vulnerable. Black masks, fire, breaking windows, I mean, that's scary. And that's violent. But I also think that sometimes violence is okay.
Okay. Really quick, I want to address the question of the plowshares kind of tactic or destruction of things that need to be destroyed. If you ask different people, they're gonna think different things need to be destroyed. If you ask somebody on death row, they might think the prison system needs to be destroyed or prisons need to be destroyed immediately, and so on. And as far as the 99% bringing up, do we want to overthrow or repair capitalism, are we a minority of people who think this? The 99% is not a homogenous mass. It's a concept that has been bandied about, and it's in many ways completely false. And just because a minority of people think something doesn't make it not legitimate to think that.
Okay, thanks very much, and we'll take another five questions. Maybe start
Hi. I was very curious to hear what folks had to say about how, in the aftermath of having violence against property and violence, political activism be characterized as terrorism by our government, how this conversation is affected by the fear of that criminalization and being characterized as terrorists within our own country.
Yes, hi. I was wondering, can the people who are advocating violence or diversity of tactics name any time, any social movement in this country, whether it was with the unions or civil rights, that violence was able to win and get that, get the action that they were trying to do pronounced into this country?
Hi, my question is to the people on this side. I want to say that I'm scared. I'm really scared when I hear you speak.
She's got a minute.
I've got a minute and I have a question. And I'm scared because I don't have any belief that there's a line, either in time or in space, that is firm enough that if you ever win, I will be safe in your world. So I want to know what gives you the confidence that you will know when to stop the violence. The second question that I have is, why do we have only two women on the panel?
I had that question.
So I hear the nonviolent side of the panel asking a really important question about how our actions read to people we want to support our movements. And I think that's a very important question to consider. But what I'd like to turn back around and say is, and ask, is how do you deal with, if you want an action to read as nonviolent, no one in your mass of people can do anything violent. And that requires a lot of control over the people. How do you deal with getting that control in a way that's nonviolent? And what do you do when one person throws a rock? How can you be a nonviolent movement and still have solidarity with that person?
So my experience with this conversation is in Occupy Oakland has been around the question of whether or not we have agreements. And my question is, for everyone on the panel, if you support agreements, the idea of having agreements with for us as a movement, and what those agreements might be, and if you don't support having agreements, what kind of internal structures can we have so that we can trust and work with one another?
So that's that for that round of questions. So we're going to start with responses on my right. So you have 4 minutes collectively to respond to the questions, and then we'll switch to my left. So go ahead.
I'm going to try and answer two of these really quickly. It was asked, how is the fear of being criminalized or labeled a terrorist affecting this conversation? Which I think at once was a question and a rhetorical statement, because that fear, that label, definitely is affecting this conversation. Again, I mention the catastrophic imaging that we're able to conjure. So I think one way in which it definitely affects this conversation is that it makes us scared to think outside of the norms, the things that we cling to. Linking arms, welding ourselves into pipes, climbing trees, blocking traffic, handing out flyers, marching on a Saturday. I think that we are afraid of being criminalized by the police, and we are afraid of being labeled as terrorists. And we see what the police do to criminals, and we see what they do to terrorists, and even though we're not saying it out loud, we know what that is, and we don't want to be that. I'm going to actually not answer the other question, because I want to make time for my comrades up here. We're egalitarians up here.
No, you, please.
Okay, well, as far as, yeah, that first question about how is this conversation affected by criminalization, I think that it was put really well. But I want to add that, you know, the fear of, well, one thing is the fear of other people in the movement, the question that was asked about how do you control people in the movement, and I think that's one of the main fundamental flaws of this kind of idea of having to define it a certain way or keeping the movement quote unquote nonviolent. It's impossible to control what everybody who comes to a rally is going to do or comes to a march, and if it gets aggressive, if it gets more confrontational, you know, and are you going to turn the people who throw rocks through a window over to the police? Are you going to submit them to that legal repression, to the potential torture and violence under police hands? And as I witnessed on November 2nd, the only violence I saw against people was committed by the so-called peace police, the people who are trying to, be the marshals and keep things nonviolent. I saw them at Whole Foods attacking people with chairs. I saw them trying to hit people with sticks. I saw them trying to, tear people's masks off. And this is completely unacceptable. This is not the kind of, that's not the kind of world I want to live in. And if that's what nonviolent people, or these, I'm not saying they speak or act for everyone, who agrees with nonviolence, but I just think there's a really inherent contradiction in that. And also really quick, I really respect the question about, being scared and nervous, talking about these things, because it's terrifying. But the thing about the violence is that it's already begun. It's been going on for centuries, the violence of authorities, of the state, of the police, of, authority against people. And I'm going to have to stop so everybody else has time to speak. But just, I think it's a really scary thing, but we have to resist because this has been going on for so long, and our violence against those forces are really, or our resistance against those forces are really important.
Okay. Real quick, as an example of social movements where violence was used, I think the labor movement is a great example in the early part of the 20th century, where you had workers that literally were picking up pipes and other types of weapons to fight back against people that were trying to take them out. I think the civil rights movement, despite the myth that we are all usually taught, actually did have armed groups that existed in parallel to the more nonviolent groups that we learn about. We just don't know about that. And that's my point, is that these things don't exist in isolation from each other. The second thing I'll say is, how does the political activism categorize as terrorists affect this? I think it's the transparency is affected. I think the request for transparency when it comes to diversity of tactics is a valid one. I think we run into problems because you can't be transparent with a lot of these things or you're thrown in fucking prison. And that's the real, so.
All right, so the folks on my left, perhaps the folks who didn't speak the last round could start off, and you have 4 minutes collectively.
Christoph, your question around how can we make sure the movement as a whole remains nonviolent. One of the people that trained me in nonviolence is a guy by the name of Dr. Bernard Lafayette, who was one of the leaders of the Nashville Lunch Counter Synods. And those people, they trained for a year before they participated in any direct action. And I feel like we live in a society where things are just so rushed, and it's the microwave society, right? We need to train our folks, and we need to have discipline and unity before we hit the streets. I know there's always going to be individuals who want to engage in acts of property destruction and things like that, but we have to recognize that this movement, and movements in general, it's not about any one individual's desire to express their anger. It's about our collective liberation. And in order for us to get there, we need to be united and we need to be disciplined, which is something that I feel is lacking in this movement as far as discipline. As far as the agreements, I think agreements around diversity of tactics is absolutely critical, especially in order for us to be transparent. Because if you tell me up front that if I come to this march and some people might be busting windows, Starhawk said this, I'm not going to come. And I feel like I have a right to know that. And if I'm outreaching to the kids on my block, and who many of them who have records, and if I'm telling them to come through at an event where you might get arrested just by marching, they have a right to know that. So saying the diversity of tactics without having those agreements is not transparent, and it's not fair, and it's not cool.
Yeah, let me see if I can sort of speak to a number of these quickly. I would say, again, you know, I think all of us come out of a culture that is rooted in systems of control and domination. And under stress, unless we have training and practice to do something different, we tend to revert to that. And that is true. You know, there are people who advocate nonviolence, but they're advocating it sort of comes out in the voice of dad. You must do this or you are bad. And they do tend to become very controlling. I've also heard the same thing about other people who are doing other things too. So it's not limited to any one group. And I think one of the advantages of a framework of strategic nonviolence is it does include training. I actually think even diversity of tactics is important to have training so that we can act together more effectively on the streets. I also think around tactics, it's like, what tactic where? I mean, that goes back to the Plowshares question too. It's like, it's not about, you can't say property destruction is violent or nonviolent without saying what property, in what context. If the Nazis are coming over the bridge, I say blow it up, you know, right? But if you've got a mass of people of different ages, you know, all in the middle of a demonstration and somebody throws a rock through a window, I'm sorry, I'm too slow to run away, right? So in terms of parallel movements, you know, parallel movements might someday be necessary and important, but I'm talking about Occupy this movement where I think our strengths are and what I think best serves us. And finally, in terms of common ground, I think we have enormous common ground on this panel and in this room, far more common ground than we have differences. And that common ground is really our passion for a world of justice.
So David should be up in the balcony, and I can't see up there, so David, just go ahead and take five questions, try to balance them a bit.
Hey, so first I want to apologize for those of you who maybe this question is not sophisticated enough, or I'm gonna ask you guys to just meet me where I'm at. So first I want to say that I'm not set on either nonviolence or diversity of tactics as being the way forward. I'm trying to learn this stuff, and one of you seemed to refer to the use of force as being necessary in defending ourselves against violent gangs like the police. So my question is, for those of us who know nothing about symmetrical or asymmetrical warfare, and who live and breathe this movement because for us it means more, it means living for more than just surviving in this lifetime, how do you propose that we differentiate between a good gang or a bad gang?
I don't have a question. I just want to announce that the visual people at the plaza are being raided by the cops right now, and they've requested support. If anybody wants to head out there after this event, they would request it.
My question is actually trying to understand, like, you know, there's a lot of nonviolence. It seems like it involves a lot of training, et cetera. And it seems like a lot of this training is geared towards, you know, like really how to take the, you know, the blows by the police or chemical weapons, how to go to jail, you know, these kinds of tactics. And I'm curious if the people who are experienced in this and have been trained can speak to kind of some of the religious underpinnings of nonviolent methods. And I think it's pretty clear that some of these have arisen from like religious backgrounds. And also, especially when we look at Occupy Oakland, I think that a lot of the participants, at least in, you know, in Oscar Grant Plaza, definitely don't want to go to jail again, you know, and don't want to be beat by the cops again. So where in this nonviolent framework is a place for them?
Yeah, I'm just a little bit frustrated by the framework of this dialogue in that, I guess, so two short questions. One is for diversity of tactics folks. We make agreements about how we make decisions in General Assembly, and so what's with the refusal to discuss strategy or make any agreements about what we do or don't do at actions? And the lack of doing that has opened us up to police provocateurs, to entrapment, and plays into the hands of the state, I would argue. And I'd say for the folks on the nonviolent side, and I feel like the debate is first, it's not nonviolence versus diversity of tactics, is should we make agreements and discuss strategy or not? And then what are those tactics and strategies? So for the folks on the nonviolent side, how can you expect folks to seriously take nonviolence seriously when we have Gene Kwan, heads of universities, people who are upholders of the status quo, constantly calling on us to engage in peaceful protests and nonviolence, when what they mean is they want us to be polite and not engage in confrontation and conflict, which is how we make social change.
One more. Yeah, I have a question. I guess it's for everybody, but trying to listen to this kind of dispassionately, I have several times been struck with the rather paradoxical feeling that the people who are arguing for the diversity of tactics are actually speaking from a somewhat privileged attitude, thinking that whatever they want to do, it's perfectly okay to inflict the consequences on anybody else who happens to be there, who maybe don't have those privileges, people with immigration issues, people with disabilities, people of color, children. So the only way, it seems to me, to welcome to the occupation those constituencies and make them feel safe is by agreeing to have agreements for time and space. I don't think we'll ever resolve the difference between philosophical commitment to nonviolence and tactical, but to not have those tactical agreements to me seems completely counterproductive.
All right, so we'll start to my right. You have 4 minutes collectively to respond to those questions.
Hi, I'm gonna respond to that last question, the paradox of privilege. I think that we should think about privilege. I have actually mentioned that a number of times tonight. I've also mentioned that, in fact, we should have agreements. I've heard other people on this panel express why sometimes there is a lack of transparency, and that is, again, fear of prison, fear of recrimination, fear of... I was reading a comment from somebody within Occupy Oakland who was like, if those people who was breaking windows come by here again, well, I'm gonna punch their fucking face. I mean, this was in the Chronicle. So this kind of fear, it's real, okay? I also wanna speak on behalf of myself as a... large black woman who does not actually like to run. I don't like to run from the cops. I think that it's reasonable to not want to run from the cops. As a person who grew up in a working class household, who paid my way through most of college, didn't graduate, I think that like the understanding of privilege is a little bit limited, and I get kind of annoyed with the those of you on the diversity of tactics panel must be of like mostly white or middle class. That doesn't apply for me. I'm just a critical thinker. I'm gonna leave it there so that other people can answer other questions.
So I'll jump right in. If what comes out of tonight is sort of a tacit understanding between those who are going to engage in a diversity of tactics and those who wanna be in the know in terms of what those tactics are gonna be at various actions, I think that's fucking awesome. I think it is awesome that we come to an understanding of how we're all going to work together on the street. Now, in terms of training, someone brought that up, awesome point. A lot of our nonviolent activists have been training for years to do it right. I have gone through years of nonviolence training too. I've also been trained in the United States military. I'm a former Marine, so I've gotten some of the violence training as well. And then I've spent years practicing my martial art to better me, to understand how I'm going to use violence, to understand when violence is important, to be able to deal with that toxic substance that is violence. So if more trainings like that need to happen, if we need to start contextualizing violence for people, going beyond learning how to lock down but learning how to resist, I think that's awesome too.
In response to the question about the privileged attitude, I think there is a lot of different elements of privilege present on both sides of this debate. That's unquestionable, and that's really important to acknowledge, that you know many of us come from educated backgrounds and have class privilege, race privilege, but that doesn't change the fact that it's an absolutely patronizing attitude to say that women and even children and anybody else, you know, like that people of color or immigrants don't or can't fight back for themselves and can't handle a situation where the police are present or don't know how to handle it themselves. I think if you look at some of the pictures from the Oaxacan uprising in 2006, you can see some beautiful images of children, probably pre-adolescents, throwing rocks at the police, fighting back for themselves. You can, there's many different examples of marginalized groups self-organizing and, you know, striving to defend themselves. One really good example recently is the Bash Back group, a network of queers who organized to defend themselves. It started in the Midwest, and you know they passed out pepper spray to their friends, organized in small crews, and to defend themselves from homophobic attacks. You know, many people will say that these marginalized groups should be accounted for when thinking about these situations. And I don't contest that exactly, but I just think it's a patronizing attitude.
All right, folks to my left, you have 4 minutes collectively to respond to the questions. One minute each. Great.
On the religious underpinnings of nonviolence, I would say I maybe come from a different place. I come from pagan nonviolence, not Christian or Hindu nonviolence. I'm not that into accepting suffering if I can avoid it. Right? Though I see the value and the power and the strength in that, but and also around trainings. I've done trainings for years, and when I do a training, I don't believe as a trainer I should be telling people this is the right way or the wrong way to do things. I believe what I teach people is here's a range of options, and here's how to stay in a state of awareness where you can make a choice and where you can assess what's going on and make your own decisions rather than going into panic. And, you know, even a couple hours of training before an action can help people a lot. And the more training we can do, I think, the more, a lot of the training is about how do we act together effectively? How do we decide whether to hold space, move through space? If we want to do that, how do we do that together?
All right, for the question, what's good and bad? I just say that, you know, as long as your action conveys the struggle that we're engaged in to the public, then it's positive, you know. The thing that really kicked off Occupy Wall Street was the fact that those women got pepper sprayed, unprovoked. Then, you know, my friend Scott got injured, and he was standing there, you know, with his Veterans for Peace t-shirt on, with a peace sign raised. And it is that that allows you to maintain your ethical or moral high ground in the views of the general public. And for those people that, you know, are not well suited, they're not prepared to be arrested or beat, I think there are many examples of people offering material or physical support to Occupy, you know, whether it be providing some sandwiches, cleaning up around camp, just making whatever it is Occupy needs to do to get bigger, making it easier.
I want to say a couple of things. I want to suggest that when we talked about occupying Wall Street as the movement began, that in itself was the reason why the conversation around the nation changed, because it was Occupy Wall Street. And that resonated with people around the globe. The moment we changed our conversation, our words, to Occupy Oakland or Occupy San Francisco, we changed the whole message so that the citizens, for example, of Oakland said, we don't need to be occupied. We changed the message from Wall Street to Oakland or San Francisco. I think that was tragic to do that. I want to close with a quote by Gandhi that I think nonviolence as a way of life addresses. Gandhi said, I have only three enemies. My favorite enemy, the one most easily influenced for the better, is the British people. The second enemy, the Indian people, are far more difficult to influence. But my most difficult, formidable enemy is a man named Mohandas K. Gandhi. With him, I seem to have very little influence. The reason nonviolence works, will work in the United States, is because it gets us to dealing with our own enemies, ourselves, that we have to become changed. We have to become the change that we want to bring about in the nation. That means we can't play around with the poison that's a part of being in the United States, racism and violence and special privileges. We have to reject that as well as reject violence.